Chapter 6, Genesis, verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the ground, man and beast and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. The flood. I was playing squash with a friend once, and trying to buy a little time in after one hectic rally, trying to recover my breath, so I pointed at the wall for a moment, and I said, what's that mark doing on the wall with a date beside it? He said to me, oh, that is the high water mark of the time when we had a great flood here. And we registered that as being the high water mark there with a little date by it to remind us when the entire squash court had been flooded. And I suppose there are some moments in society that make us do that. We say, that was the time when such a thing happened. Some events are indelibly etched upon our lives and upon our consciousness. At the present time, we've just concluded the second coldest February of the century. We all know that, probably. First one being the 1947. You don't go back to that. 1962. Some of us go back to the 1962 one. I thought that was colder than the one we just had. The national consciousness goes back to the Great Fire of London. But if we were to talk about the fire, somebody is bound to say to us, well, which fire are you talking about? And we'd have to explain that we were talking about the fire of London in 1666. That was the one we meant. No such explanation is needed, however, when we talk about the flood. It's passed not simply into the national consciousness, but into the global consciousness. It's one of the great indelible landmarks in the fortunes of humanity, cutting clean across religions and cultures and geographical boundaries. It is the account where we read in Genesis 6 and verse 6 of the Creator's grief over his creation, vividly, Jewishly expressed. And two twin themes begin to weave their way through the biblical revelation from this point, judgment on the one hand and grace on the other, but both together. So the fall of humankind, portrayed in chapter 3, has led to the intrusion of evil. Murder enters the Bible at chapter 4. And now in chapter 6, verse, 6, we read that the earth was corrupt in God's sight. And the earth was filled with violence. That's verse 11, I should say. Filled with violence. Muggings and assassinations were commonplace in that society. Once man had turned rebel and was off the leash. What would you have done at that point in history? Perhaps the answer would have been to bring together all the idlers and the drunkards and the con men and the pimps and the muggers and take them to the middle of the Atlantic and sink them. That is what God did. And who shall say that the Creator doesn't have the right to do that with a part of his creation that is deliberately causing chaos on a single planet and laughing at him in the process? Verse 7, so the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the ground. And the beasts, of which the humans had become custodians, became linked to them in judgment. But, verse 8, Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And it's one of the first buts of the Bible. The first one, I think, being the one in chapter 3, but the serpent said to the woman, you shall not die. But I love these buts of the grace of God that come through the Bible. And this is about the first one, telling about his intervening and innovating grace. The but of verse 8 here meant that there was a ray of hope shining through the storm cloud of approaching judgment. True, it was there because of one man only, a righteous man, as verse 9 tells us. So Noah and his household alone are isolated for salvation. And they become the pivot on which these themes of judgment and grace are going to turn. 14 years ago, an Orthodox Jew called Maya Ben Uri, whose hobby was that of reconstructing Old Testament objects, built a model of Noah's Ark and exhibited it in Jerusalem. He rid himself of current architectural ideas and projected his thoughts to an age along the Persian Gulf when bamboo and pitch served as construction materials. And he figured that the ark weighed about 6,000 tons and that Noah, with the assistance of workmen, would have had no difficulty, even though not an informed man about these matters, no difficulty in building a rhomboid design of two equal triangles joined along their bases. That's how he reasoned it out. And Uri built his model, and he said, it is eminently workable. The Ark of Noah, the flood of Noah, have become woven into the psyche, the consciousness of humanity everywhere. And perhaps that's the first main thing to be stressed in this sermon now. Have you ever heard a sermon, by the way, about the flood? I have not, until tonight. This is my first one on it. I've preached about Noah as a character study, but I've never preached about the flood before. Maybe for somebody else, this is your first. The flood one is embedded in our memory. The first thing I'd like to establish. It is embedded in our memory. Virtually everywhere. There's a Hindu tradition about a great flood and a ship of safety finally landing on a northern mountain. In China, Fa He, the reputed founder of Chinese civilization, is represented as escaping from the waters of a deluge and reappears as the first man in a new world, accompanied by his wife, three sons and three daughters, eight people in all. There's the famous Babylonian epic of Gilgamesh with its detailed myth legend of a great flood. The Fiji Islanders have accounts of a flood in which a family of eight are saved in a canoe. In South America, paintings have been found, ancient paintings representing a flood, a man and his wife on a raft with a mountain featuring in the story, as also a dove. The Cherokee Indians have a similar story. Only in Africa, it appears, are these stories absent. The flood is embedded in our memory. What actually happened? Was it a flood that embraced the entire world, including the Himalayas and the Alps and the Andes? Where did the water come from? Where did it go back to afterwards? The end of the Quaternary Ice Age could hardly account for such a release of water. And yet, we don't have to be cynical, patronizing, or irreverent when we come to this amazing book, an exciting book of Genesis. And as I understand it, this definitive interpretation of the flood. Let's remember that we are the creatures who are under judgment. So that I reject the seedy liberalism of the late 19th century, which airily dismisses the sober presentation of Genesis with a few half-baked, untried, untested scientific theories. As we read Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9, the account actually reads like that of an eyewitness. Was it Shem, one of Noah's sons, who later on told his children, and then his grandchildren, of the greatest epic of his life, and that these children passed it on, perhaps? And that as the human race spread outwards from Mesopotamia, so the story traveled outwards as well, sometimes maybe getting a little garbled in the process and mixed up with perhaps legend and local fables? After all, there's no biblical reason why the flood, as seen and narrated by an eyewitness, shouldn't have been relatively local. That it was a gigantic flood was evident. We don't honestly know if it was the flood that the celebrated archaeologist Sir Bernard Woolley dug up in the Persian Gulf in the 30s. A flood of about 6,000 years back. It could have been. That was a gigantic flood. And he reported it to America and Britain. It was flashed across the newspapers. We have found the flood. Whether it was the flood, that must still remain an imponderable. Certainly the flood of the Bible seems to have been a Mesopotamian disaster, if not of a wider area, accompanied by heavy rain and by what chapter 7 verse 11 describes as the fountains of the great deep bursting forth evidently a tremendous displacement of water. How many animals were there in the ark? We shall never know, but presumably no more than 8 people could adequately feed, clean and water over a period of months. See, my Noah's Ark that I played with when I was a little boy had giraffes, lions, crocodiles, elephants, zebras, leopards. In fact, most of the wildlife that you can find in Africa. Noah's Ark may have had a different assortment of animal life on board. Genesis is no more a textbook on zoology any more than it is a textbook on geography. So that as Noah, with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives, and Mrs. Noah, looked upon their world, all that could be seen was a mass of water and vapor and clouds everywhere, and not a hill in sight. That's what they saw. That's what they report. It's actually futile, I think, for trips to be made to Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey to find the remains of the ark somewhere at the top of its 17,000-foot peak. It may not have been that Ararat. And in any case, the biblical account tells us in chapter 8, verse 4, that it was on the mountains, that is, on the Ararat range, that the ark finally rested. If only the curious would leave their Woolworth's children's Bibles in the cupboard, they could have saved themselves an awful lot of bother and time and expense. Then even if it was a localized flood, that in no way lessens the universal inspiration of the flood. What it says to us, and its implication for us today. I liken it, you see, to Krakatoa, that island in Indonesia which finally blew its top off some decades ago. It was local, but it reverberated around the world. And every country, in fact, in the world at that time reported brilliant sunsets as the dust of Krakatoa became carried around the world. It affected the world. Similarly with Mount St. Helens, with that explosion. Similarly with the flood. It was perhaps a localized event, relatively speaking, but with a universal, never-to-be-forgotten impact. The flood is embedded in our memory. Pictures of it are found in the Sistine Chapel in Rome and everywhere. It is embedded in our memory. Secondly, the flood is embodied in our theology. For what is the significance of the flood and the ark? Chapter 6, verse 18 gives us the clue. But I will establish my covenant with you, says God. And as Derek Kidner puts it in his brilliant little Tyndale commentary, which you may have got, the best sort of easy commentary on Genesis that there is. He says, Noah goes into the ark not as a mere survivor, but as the bearer of God's promise for the new age. That's the heart of it. A covenant. A divine arrangement for the human race under judgment. A means by which a new beginning can take place through the isolated, single man of righteousness, Noah. So the arrangements are made for the family, then for the animals, a pair of each is specified, followed in chapter 7 by the further detail that sacrificial animals were to go in by sevens. There's actually a lot of theology, biblical teaching, initiated for us through this account of the flood. I'll note one or two of them quickly with you now. First, the teaching about the seriousness of sin. Without the flood, we might perhaps have seen the sin problem as a problem, certainly, but something that the world had to get along with somehow and could get along with. The flood showed us that persistent rebellion is intolerable to the rule of God. We have teaching on man here. There in chapter 6 is sinful man, unregenerate man off the leash, man in revolt, and he has to be dethroned. So it happens in Genesis. See, we're proud and conceited enough as it is, even with the flood behind us. We think that we can shrink the world. We think that we can send Voyager out into space. But let us look at the biblical picture here, and we see man certainly as great because humanity is created in the image of God. But in his frailty and basic transience, as having no more dynamism or direction in himself than a floating, flimsy, rudderless cockle shell, floating on a sea of uncertainties and liable to end up anywhere. That is basic man. Then there is a theme of judgment expressed in the flood and embodied in the rest of the Bible. It's being sounded out now, initially. Judgment. We are responsible for our actions. That is what we're learning here. We are going to be held accountable, each of us and all of us together. And all the way through the Old Testament, this theme is hammered out. And as we come to the New Testament, Christ tells his listeners that Noah's flood was only the dress rehearsal for the final punch-up, the final reality. In Matthew 24, verse 37, we read, "As were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they did not know until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." The Apostle Peter turns on the scoffers and the cynics in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, as he says, "They deliberately ignore this fact, that by the word of God, heavens existed long ago, and an earth formed out of water, by means of water, through which the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist have been stored up for fire," says Peter. He's linking the two judgments, that initial judgment of water, but he says the final judgment is on its way, and that is just the rehearsal. "It won't be by water next time," says the New Testament. God has promised that, but it will be by the fire of eternal and ultimate judgment. So judgment is given its launching pad here in Genesis, in the Genesis flood. And so is God's grace and the covenant already touched upon. What happens at the end of the flood? God again speaks in covenant terms with Noah and makes the first of many biblical agreements. This one is ratified by a rainbow, the sign of God's faithfulness and love. Genesis 9, verses 12 to 17. The value of the rainbow, ladies and gentlemen, was not that when we see it, we remember God's covenant. Rather, the value is that we remember that God remembers the covenant. And he's looking at the rainbow. He's remembering. Genesis 9, verse 16. "When the bow is in the clouds," God says, "I will look upon it and remember the everlasting covenant." So the flood is embedded in our memory, and it is embodied in our theology. You see that even in 1 Peter chapter 3, where the reference is made to baptism. The flood is like baptism. And immediately there's a little doctrine of baptism coming out of the flood of Noah. It's embedded in our memory, embodied in our theology. I put it like that so we can remember. With this theme of salvation, the first of God's many great saving actions comes in the flood. And thirdly, what we're to see here in the flood, we're to see the flood as embossed upon our testimony. Those of you who have English as your second language, when I say embossed, I mean printed, imprinted upon our own testimony as believers. The flood is there printed upon us, embossed upon us, in our world view, and the way we look at things and the way we speak of Christ and of God. The flood teaches us humility. Up to that time, the history of people was progressing reasonably in their own eyes. Then came this unforeseen intrusion into their affairs. With a single flood, all those neat programs, all those plans and agendas were turned into pulp. The challenge of God's action in judgment, in a scenario which we are not able to predict with neat precision, is that we had better set our lives in order. And in this kind of God-centered scenario, where there is a moral person at the center, these artificial schemes of history, the Hegelian ideas of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, may have to be earmarked for popping. We can only truly understand our history and our existence in the context of God and His design and purpose, culminating in the return of His Son, Jesus Christ, and the wind-up of our world at the final judgment. And that has to be imprinted upon our testimony, upon our worldview, our lifestyle, our priorities, the way we arrange our lives. It's got to have that stamp upon it. There's going to be the final punch-up. And we are going to be weighed. Even the flood says that. In 2 Peter 3, the flood is mentioned and then the fire of judgment. The apostle then urges us in verse 11, this is 2 Peter 3 verse 11, he says, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of persons ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God? What is the purpose of coming together in church? To be close to God. What is the purpose of all these Bibles? What are we really on about? What is the demonstration of power in a person's life, divinely achieved? It is that you and I become more like God in our characters. That is the demonstration of power. That here is a message. Here is a saving action. Centering ultimately and finally in the cross and the resurrection, which we celebrate tonight. Designed to put power into people's lives, to make them more godly in their character. That is the demonstration. Years ago, I asked John Stott in an interview in Essex, right out there, where the snow presumably is lying now heavily. I said to him my last question is, what are you looking forward to more than anything else in the world? With a long pause. Then Uncle John said, I think I can truthfully say that more than anything else, I look forward to being more like Jesus Christ. He said, that is what I'm looking forward to. But that's what the Bible's for. That's what this whole revelation is for. That's what the judgment is about. Ultimately, our relationship to this person, Jesus Christ, whether we are living godly lives, whether we have embraced Him into our lives and allowed Him to shape us and mold us so that we can be like Him. What sort of persons ought you to be, says the Apostle Peter, in the light of the fact that all these things are going to be dissolved, in lives of holiness and godliness? Sometimes we may feel very alone in our testimony of truth and of Christ. Somebody here, like Joan was saying in her testimony earlier on, may be taking a terrific beating from circumstances. Maybe circumstances that are hard. Perhaps because you are a believer who is struggling for truth and uprightness and purity in a world that doesn't believe in it. It's a world like Noah's time. Out of that saved family has still come corruption, difficulty, and impurity. And we're living in this hard, worldly society where everything goes. It's very hard. Let us learn from Noah in his isolation, the only righteous man left in the society. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 15. Peter loves Noah. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 15 describes Noah as a preacher of righteousness. And surely, my friend, just about the most signally unsuccessful preacher that ever lived. In all those years of preaching, not a single convert. But he held on, isolated though he was. Even his family weren't all that bright morally and spiritually. It was for Noah's sake and not theirs that they were accepted into the ark of God's covenant. Noah was isolated. And he provides inspiration for all who struggle and weep in the isolation of standing for truth and purity and nobility and standards and righteousness. How do we see the flood? It is embedded in our memory globally, I think, forever. It's embodied in our theology, for the flood was the first of God's great saving actions. It's embossed on our testimony, because the flood teaches us that if you leave God and His judgment and His call and His standards out of your reckoning, then when the swirling waters of destiny have receded, there will be no trace that you had ever existed or lived upon this beautiful blue world of ours. Let's pray now and be quiet for a moment. Then we're going to have some prayer leading us into confession and realization of God's pardoning ability. God, teach us through this account that we have been meditating upon. Enable us to take the flood seriously. Thank you for this amazing book of Genesis. And as we pursue it over these Sundays, may its imprint be upon our lives and lifestyle. For your name's sake. Amen.